From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, a new study shows off the role so-called small batch manufacturing has on the local business climate.
Then, why the son of the late Kenyan photojournalist Muhammad Amin chose Milwaukee's Chip Duncan to curate the world's first exhibit of his late father's work.
I wouldn't have trusted anyone else with them to curate them and to work on them, cropping them and touching them up and changing them in some ways, improving them, enhancing them. I know where his mind is at, and it's exactly what I think my father would have wanted.
And singer-songwriter Caitlin Canty talks about the point when she gave up using her biology degree in favor of the music life.
I did hit a moment where I actually was up for a promotion, and I quit. I just really felt like if I didn't give it a try, I never would do it.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Construction is underway in Racine County on the first elements of Foxconn's massive factory complex. Plans call for the factory to employ thousands of workers who will, at first, assemble television sets, but later are expected to build high-tech glass screens for electronic devices.
The Foxconn development elicited an unprecedented state incentive package, with advocates saying it has the potential to transform the economy of the region. But a new report out says another part of the manufacturing sector is already having a transformative effect.
Katie Stanton is the program manager for the Urban Manufacturing Alliance, which authored the State of Urban Manufacturing Report. Marcus White is vice president of civic engagement for the Greater Milwaukee Foundation. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
So what's the significance of what you would term small batch manufacturing, and why do you think it is so important to quantify the data surrounding it?
The State of Urban Manufacturing Report is a research project that the Urban Manufacturing Alliance has spearheaded in six different cities because we really wanted to understand what manufacturing looks like today. You know, folks still have a perception of manufacturing being big, dirty, repetitive, boring, and we just don't think that that's the case anymore. But we really wanted to dig in and understand what these new kind of manufacturers looked like. And so we were able to go into these six different cities, of which Milwaukee was one, work with community partners to really understand first the landscape of manufacturing in Milwaukee, and then dig into these small companies, not only their workforce demographics, but their barriers to scale, what their hopes for growth was, how they define themselves. And so now we're really looking at this new kind of manufacturer, what you reference as small batch producers. And we're seeing these more and more in cities because manufacturing, as times have changed, has shrunk, whether it's due to technology, whether it's due to space constraints. So we're really excited to sort of see what this data says about these new manufacturers.
Why was Milwaukee that one of the, you know, you said there were six cities where you did this deep dive, as the kids say these days. Why was Milwaukee an important one to include in this study?
Well, a lot of the cities that we included were in the heartland. You know, Milwaukee, just like many other cities like Detroit and Cincinnati, Baltimore, have sort of been ravaged by outsourcing.
There
you go. It was a combination. And so Milwaukee provided a really good opportunity to take a look at what was once such a powerhouse and really still is. There's so much mm-hmm. manufacturing still located here. But we also have a lot of our network is based in Milwaukee. We have some really strong partners, not only the Greater Milwaukee Foundation and our other sponsor, Bader Philanthropies, but folks in the industrial bid community, workforce nonprofits. So we really saw an opportunity to leverage our network here, and then also because of the historical context.
What's in it for the Greater Milwaukee Foundation to get this kind of data?
Well, I think similar to what Katie just described, that just given this region's legacy, I think that's what appealed to us at the Greater Milwaukee Foundation and to Bader Philanthropies to support this work, to be part of this national cohort. But we know manufacturing is still a strength here. It's one of our largest sectors for employment still in this region, and we're a national leader in that. One question we often ask is the manufacturing a strength upon which we should continue to build, or is it industry of the past that we're too dependent on? I don't know that there's an answer to that yet, but what we saw in this study is that there is indeed manufacturing happening in different ways, sometimes in smaller ways, but a lot of larger manufacturers are part of this study too. We saw what I think a lot of people see, that there is this growing maker movement, a movement that's been here for some time. And I think we've all just sort of noticed its growth. And when you have community events and things like Night Market that Nuwaukee puts on, and you see all of these local artisans, artists, and others, tells you something is brewing. And so when we had the opportunity to support this and be part of it, we were very enthusiastic to understand what is going on. How big is this sector? Is it an area that has potential for significant economic development in our region? And what do we all need to do to support that?
So is this in the Venn diagram of economic sectors, is this the overlap between the creative economy and the manufacturing industry?
I think it is, yeah.
Yeah, I would definitely say that. We ask a question in this study about how the respondents defined themselves over time at founding, and then when they took the survey, and answers ranged from artisan to maker to manufacturer to business person. And it was really interesting to see how those shifted and changed, particularly as companies grew. So at founding, folks might consider themselves a maker. 2 to 6 years later, they consider themselves a business person. And not only does that sort of speak to your intersection, the Venn diagram, but it also speaks to how organizations, whether in city government or nonprofit or community-based organizations, need to sort of understand to help these companies grow and for them to become economic development drivers.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are obviously a lot of economic analyses of the various sectors of the workforce, the various sectors of the economy. Is this a case of, you know, an industry kind of sneaking up on us, and there's just not a lot of data that's been out there that's quantified the impact yet?
I would say so. So, you know, studies often rely on national level data, maybe Bureau of Labor Statistics or NAICS codes. And again, what we were trying to get at is those folks who don't necessarily fit into that definition, maybe because they're so small that they're missed by those surveys, or maybe because their processes are new and innovative and, again, don't fit into those general NAICS codes. So,
I mean, is it a trick when some of them just don't self-identify as manufacturers?
That could be part of it, certainly. Or perhaps they're just one person, and mm-hmm. so they really slip under the radar.
Well, I think also that there's been this growth due to just the changes in commerce. And, for instance, one of the national sponsors of this work is Etsy. And, for instance, I just purchased a steel sign from a maker in California through Etsy. And just in recent years, I think we've all become accustomed to that, and it has changed, I think, the potential for artists, for makers. They are becoming businesses or manufacturers in some case, but I think the changes in commerce have allowed that kind of growth. And again, for us locally, what's the role for all of us to play in supporting that growth so that, for instance, mm-hmm. I don't continue buying signs from a guy in California?
Right. And I think there's implications there. You know, some folks who are small batch producers or makers or however they identify themselves won't want to grow. And they're mm-hmm. a very valuable part of the ecosystem. But those folks who are perhaps looking to grow, and in Milwaukee, about 94% of the respondents are looking to grow, we really have to help service providers and technical assistance providers understand how those people need support and what they need in order so that Marcus can buy a sign in Milwaukee and the company who makes it can hire their next 2 to 5 to 10 employees.
Well, so we've kind of been talking about this from the aerial view here, but let's talk about it from an on the ground sort of standpoint. What are some of the numbers that might jump out at people about, you know, both the numbers of people in this sector and the economic impact that they have?
So our study was a snapshot in time. We surveyed about 100 makers and manufacturers across the city of all sizes. And I think two things really stood out to me. First, the statistic I already listed, which 94% anticipate to be either significantly or slightly larger than they are now. I can't give you a total number of what that would be, but let's say every one of them wanted 2 to 10 employees. That's 200 to 1,000 employees mm-hmm. if we're able to support them in the right way. And that is certainly would have an effect on our neighborhoods. I think the other statistic that I'll say is that 94% of our respondents relied on personal investment to start their company, to grow their company. That has a lot of implications for growth, but also for equity. You know, we're looking at communities. I should say that manufacturing is still, we believe, a pathway out to the middle class and out of poverty. It pays living wages. It is family sustaining. But if folks are not, if they're not part of a wealthy network and they can't even start their business, how are they supposed to create jobs that can help lift others out of poverty? And so we really encourage, that was an encouraging finding, or an interesting finding, I should say, that we want to encourage people to look deeper into.
Well, and of course, we hear a lot about the kinds of incentive packages that large manufacturing companies receive in efforts to lure them here. I won't name any by name, except people are obviously thinking of the word Foxconn. What sorts of supports, as you dug into this data, what sorts of supports do you think or were the people that you spoke with saying would really make the difference to these smaller entrepreneurs?
Well, to keep banging on the same drum, access to sort of flexible financing. So rather than your traditional bank loans that require a lot of capital, really trying to look for creative partnerships between philanthropy, nonprofits, city government, other lenders, in order to give these businesses the sort of flexible capital. And I know the city of Milwaukee has a very successful partnership with Kiva, which is very encouraging and exciting to have learned about. And we're seeing that in a number of different cities. But thinking about how to expand that and to help, you know, get folks beyond the 5 to 10,000 range and between the 50 and 500,000 range.
In terms of their sales? That's...
In terms of, sure, sales, but more so the amount of loan that they would need.
I see. Yeah.
Right. And so is there a public policy implication for this? Is this, you know, creating a climate where that sort of thing is more readily available?
Well, I think there's great opportunity there. And Mitch, there's two things I want to do. There's four things stuck out for me about the challenges that business owners and makers are feeling. And then there's the contextual piece, too, in this particular to this region. So as Katie said, financing is one of those. Access to capital was a theme in this report. Finding new customers was a theme. The need for employees, and that may get even more difficult. And space. And I think all of those things, capital, finding new customers, employees, and space are the types of things where local government, state government, philanthropy, nonprofit sector, chambers of commerce, and other business owners can all collaborate to help promote those locally produced goods and find those new customers, to come up with new, more patient financing models. Obviously, we're willing to do that, whether it's a large screen manufacturer or a giant facility for professional sports. We have a commitment here to putting public dollars into those. And we're certainly not going to argue that that's a bad strategy. The report actually acknowledges that, indeed, local communities still need to go after large employers. That's always going to be part of the mix. But what else can you do to begin building wealth and, frankly, creating ways for innovation and creativity to become a business? This community, with its history of manufacturing, is a community that innovates. It's what we've been like for a long, long time. And what we see here is that on a smaller scale, that spirit, that sort of Milwaukee's spirit of being the workshop to the world, continues. So as a matter of policy, what can we all do to support those things? In the contextual piece, Kay talked about equity. We're in a region right now, our four-county metro area is one-third people of color. When you look at people under age 25 in our four-county region, it's 45% people of color. And preschoolers in our four-county region are now majority people of color. Our region's future is tied to communities of color. And one thing we heard in the study is that people of color who are trying to make a go of it didn't feel like they had the same kind of access to financing and capital. And that's something we have to be very intentional about, because we can build this region to be one where everyone thrives. And I think that's going to be part of the mix. How can we be more intentional about the kind of tools that are needed and who can access those tools?
At this stage, with the data that you've now seen, do you come out of it with some level of optimism about what is possible?
For sure. The report to me was far more encouraging than I was expecting. I was expecting, I think, I might have hypothesized that we'd hear a lot about struggle. And that's in there, but there is far more optimism and hope. So to me, that's what's really exciting, that it's even more vibrant of a sector than I might have anticipated. So I think there is great potential there in all kinds of ways. And one of the things the report mentions is perhaps unlike some of the cities that Katie just cited, we don't have what the report refers to as someone at the helm. And that might be a next step for our region for a public-private partnership. We need someone at the helm who can pull together these things, who can say, if we're going to invest in these types of things, these are also worth investment. And so I think that's a next step for us. But it is an exciting time. And again, I had mentioned before that there are all kinds of places we all bump into events with local manufacturers. And so I think everybody knows that there's something cool going on. How can we support it and grow it?
Well, thank you so much for sharing this report with us and getting us thinking about it as well.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Mitch.
Marcus White is Vice President of Civic Engagement for the Greater Milwaukee Foundation. Katie Stanton is the Program Manager for the Urban Manufacturing Alliance, which authored the State of Urban Manufacturing Report. You'll find a link to it at WUWM.com.
Coming up after a break, we'll talk with the creators of a new photography exhibit on view at the Charles Alice Museum. That's when Lake Effect returns on WUWM.
Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. It is hard to overstate what a prolific photojournalist Mohamed Amin was in his relatively short life. When the Kenyan native died in 1996, he left behind 2.5 million still photographs and more than 5,000 hours of raw video shot over 33 years. Until now, almost none of that work has been displayed in the United States.
The first exhibit of his work in the world is now open at Milwaukee's Charles Alice Museum. It was curated by Amin's son, Salim, and Milwaukee photojournalist and filmmaker Chip Duncan, whose work is also part of the exhibit. Amin and Duncan were in town last week to opened the exhibit and visited us in the studio then. Amin explained how their friendship and collaboration began.
So I made a documentary on my father's life in 2006 called Mo and Me, which was Al Jazeera's launch documentary for their English language channel. And one of the people I interviewed for that was Harry Belafonte, who was in the film. So when I launched it in New York at the New York Film Festival, I went to see Harry just to give him a copy of the film to say thank you and for him to see it. I then went to Los Angeles for the LA Film Festival from New York, and Harry called me up and said, you know, I've just watched the documentary and, you know, this should be made into a feature film. So I was like, well, that's very kind of you, but I don't know anything about making feature films. That's not my line of work. And he was like, well, leave it with me. And a few hours later, I got a call from Danny Glover, who,
as you do,
as one does,
yes.
Who said, look, Harry has asked me to, you know, have a look at your documentary and I need to see it. And I sent him a copy and we kept corresponding with him and his business partner. And they said, right, fine, we'll buy the rights for your father's story. We want the rights. And the next stage would be to get a writer to Nairobi to start doing the research and to start spending some time with you. And lo and behold, a couple of months later, Mr. Duncan shows up at my house in Nairobi, and that's where our friendship started. The feature film hasn't been made yet; it's still in the works. But our friendship started from there, and we ended up doing tons of new projects and documentaries together. That's my version, so I'm not sure what yours is.
What's yours, Chip? Is that about
actually
the same?
It's pretty close. I knew Danny as well, and Danny and his business partner, Jocelyn Barnes, saw some similarities between the way I approach my craft and the way that Mo approached his, and I'm also a writer. So whether I cross the finish line as the writer is yet to be determined, but regardless, my photographic style and my documentary style were very similar to Mo's. And so the more I got into the archives, started curating Mo's work, and then eventually editing some of his work for publication, It just made sense for us to try and bring a show together that featured both of us. Now, sadly, Mo passed away in 1996, so while he's not a part of it, we're really lucky at the Charles Alice Museum to have Salim Amin. And, you know, his presence in the exhibition is well noted.
You mentioned that, or it was mentioned in the articles that I was reading, that you never have an opportunity to actually meet. But do you feel that you have, in a way, becoming friends with Salim?
From everything I have learned about Mo, Salim is a much nicer guy.
Is that true?
Very true, I think. Okay. I think I'm far nicer.
And but, in terms of going out to dinner, I think I'm with the right one. Mm. But having said that, Mo was prolific. And really, he started with a camera at a very early age and was publishing images by the time he was 13, and carried his career much longer and much further than most photojournalists ever do, even though he died at a very young age. He built one of the largest archives on earth of independent content. And so I feel like I got to know him. I've interviewed everybody in his world, from his wife to one of his traveling companions, to several of his colleagues, his son. I do feel like I got to know him very
and,
well.
And I think that actually they would have got on really, really well. I see so many similarities between Chip's work and my father's work, between their work ethic, because I've been in the field with both of them, how they operate in the field and how they create these relationships with the people they photograph. And, you know, when people come and see the pictures that Chip has shot and the relationship he has with the subjects, you can only get that if you are truly spectacular at your work and create this bond that allows people to be very comfortable around you when you're photographing them. That, to me, is the biggest asset that a photojournalist has, is when they can make their subject feel so comfortable that they are, you know, revealing themselves to you, and it comes out in the photographs. The joy, the tears, the laughter, it's all there. And I just feel that that was the uniqueness of both of their work. And when you see them side by side, I think they would have been great friends. My dad might have tried to, you know, shaft him in business or something at some point, but other than that, I think they would have been great friends.
So you think the images and the way of looking at the world speak to each other? They have a relationship on the wall.
Absolutely. You know, when I look at the pictures together, while they're different eras, I think the art and the connection between the subject and the photographer are quite similar and unique. And just by watching both of them in the field and operating them, I wouldn't have trusted anybody else with my dad's images, because they're obviously very special to me. But I wouldn't have trusted anyone else with them to curate them and to work on them, cropping them and touching them up and you know, changing them in some ways, improving them, enhancing them. But, you know, I know where his mind is at, and it's exactly what I think my father would have wanted. And he was very private with his work. This is the first time ever that his work has been exhibited, the body of his work has been exhibited anywhere in the world, because he was very private about it. He shot pictures for himself.
Do you think that this could have happened were he still alive?
I don't know. It's a very good question, buddy. I don't know if it would have happened, because, like I said, for him, it wasn't about making money. It wasn't about selling prints. It was a very personal thing to him. So I'm not sure it would have happened.
He did publish extensively, and he was a preeminent storyteller who used the camera as his toolbox. And so he shot motion and he shot stills, and he had a personality that was global. Frequently, you'll hear people who say, "Well, you know, that based on whatever your ethnicity is, you might limit yourself to photographing other people who are like you." Neither he nor I have ever done that. And so Mo was comfortable going into any community. He could work in Pakistan, anywhere in East Africa. He could work in South America. It didn't really matter, because his personality somehow was such that he gained people's trust.
So what do you think differentiates what you do, Chip, and what Mo did from, say, a portrait photographer? How does this become photojournalism?
Well, I would say, I mean, in terms of my father's work, there are very few photographers that are as versatile as he was. So he shot everything from, you know, frontline war and famine and genocide and dictators. So news, hard news, as well as wildlife and flora and fauna and people and cultures and mountains and beaches. So he did everything, which not many photographers do. Chip is also in that same category. Not many photographers can be versatile. They specialize in a particular type of photography, reportage or portraiture or whatever it might be. And it's, I thought it was very unique of both of their styles that they could do all these different types of images. And for me, what was it always surprised me and pleasantly surprised me in some ways, irritated me in many ways. I used to go to the game parks with him. So we'd go, you know, to the national parks on the weekends. And he would, you know, find a pride of lions and he would sit with this pride for like 9 hours waiting for them to do something. You know, waiting for that perfect picture for the lion to open their mouth to go and go for a kill, play with the cubs. For me, it was really difficult to relate this man to the hustler who was frantic in the field when it was a frontline situation, but you know, who needed to get that image in a high tension, high impact situation, and someone who could sit for 6 or 7 or 8 hours waiting for a lion or an elephant or somebody to do something interesting. That to me was a passion. And Chip's like that as well. They're very patient. You know, these days when we go out, you know, in the field together, I just tell him, listen, you take the pictures. I'm just going to, you know, I'm chilling. You know, you've got it, I've got it, whatever, you know. They're both the same. I don't feel like carrying cameras around and going there. But he'll spend hours sitting, talking to somebody, you know, getting them comfortable, and then taking the photograph afterwards.
I started my career in TV news as a TV news photographer, and there's a hurry up and wait quality to it. But you learn... You learn a lot of the same skills that a portrait photographer would apply to their work. But for the most part, I'm not comfortable in a studio environment. I'm comfortable outdoors with natural light and the chaos of the world around me. So Mo clearly was as well. In my documentary work, obviously, I have to do a certain amount of studio and lighting type work as well. And he would do that. I mean, Mo shot Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous at one point. I mean, he did.
Did he really?
Yeah, with Robin Leach, if you remember that show.
Do.
Yeah. So he did Brooke Shields in Kenya. That was where that episode was shot. And she signed a photograph of the crew all together and said, you know, dear Mohammed, it was fun working with you. Dangerous, but fun. He was very comfortable, whether it was princes or paupers.
Or lions,
he was very comfortable in every environment. You know, it didn't matter to him. For him, the passion was in taking the photos.
So besides introducing the rest of the world to your father's legacy, what do you hope that people are going to take away from this combined exhibit? And that's a question for both of you.
I hope that people can get a much better understanding of how the camera can be used as a tool of journalism and storytelling. And in a world where we are constantly bombarded with what is now the new term, fake news or alternative facts or some of these ridiculous concepts, that the camera doesn't lie. And so, you know, whatever you're seeing, whether it's a Mo Amin photograph of Bobby Kennedy or one of my Maasai images, whatever it is, neither one of us set up our shots. They are the truth as we saw it in that instant. And so anytime we can promote photojournalism as a tool for the truth, I think it's a good way to go about it. And I think that's probably my greatest hope is, you know, bridge building, looking at how one culture is similar to another and how ultimately as humans we really are all pretty much the same. Those are big themes that I think come out of the show.
Well, you know, you said the camera doesn't lie, and I would agree with you, but people do. And I think the fear a lot of people have now is that the images are altered because it's so easy to do that, particularly with digital images.
Well, and to speak to that point, I have a new book that comes out along with the show called Inspiring Change. And I do not do any cropping with my images. I do not eliminate anything from the shot or add anything to the shot. I use traditional darkroom techniques, and that's it. Now, Salim mentioned that I've edited Mo's work, and I have, but all I'm trying to do with the editing of Mo's work is to essentially put it in a fashion that allows it to be printed in a contemporary way. So to give you a sense of what I mean, Mo was shooting mostly slides or negatives. I'm shooting almost entirely digital. So you know, what goes into the computer is different. And so we've had, in some cases, the opportunity to scan the slides ourselves. In others, we're working with slides from the CameraPix archive that have already been scanned. But some of the images have been damaged over time. Some of the images have lost the native color that you would expect to see.
So that's
in
more
an old
restoration.
Kodachrome.
You're talking more restoration.
It really is more restoration. But I had to develop it, with the color images in particular. When I look at Mohs color images, I had to make some choices about the way color is interpreted in those images. Whether Mo would like it, I don't know. I'm confident that Salim is on board. But for example, how an image is saturated or what level of vibrancy I might use to bring out what I think was probably in that original Kodachrome 64 slide from 1978, that's more or less the editing that we're talking about. So I might enhance some black levels. I might take the brightness down, add some contrast, that sort of thing, which I would do with my own images. In Mohs, I'm also developing a color palette.
And you think it's fair, what you've seen?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, some of these images are 50, 40, 50, 60 years old. So they have been damaged over time, some of them. The colors have faded because of the state of the film. You know, Chip has never changed the meaning of the photographs. And for any of us, either him or I, it's difficult for us to know what that meaning was supposed to be because neither of us were there when these pictures were taken. But knowing my father's work, I know exactly what he was thinking. And for me, what I want out of this exhibition, and hopefully there will be many more that we will do, because we have, you know, 2.5 to 3 million images. And this is a small, very small number that we've shown. One is to reintroduce the continent and the history of the continent to the rest of the world, because I think there is a lot of misconceptions about Africa that are still there. And these images hopefully will help people understand the continent and where we've come from and where we're going a little bit better. I've always felt that if you don't know your history, then you can never move forward. So not just for Africans, but for people around the world. And I take the Black Panther analogy out of it, that the Wakandas, we had kingdoms long before Western civilization came along. The Ethiopians had these wonderful kingdoms that were there, very advanced kingdoms. We built the pyramids, without any help from people from the West. So, you know, there is an enormous amount of amazing history that has come out of Africa. And I hope this will be something that we can bring out in these photographs and hopefully use them as an educational tool as well within schools, universities. That's also part of the project that we're trying to do, is to not just display the stuff, but get the support to be able to put all this content into primary schools and high schools and universities around the world, where people can actually understand some of the great things about the continent.
So this is the first step.
Yes, definitely. It's the first step, and it's taken us a long time to get here as well. And it's not easy finding the support for that. And I'm hoping that once we get it out there and people actually see it, it's easier to sell, you know, an actual exhibition as an idea where people can physically see what's there rather than just a concept or a document. So we're hoping that that will lead into bigger and better things. And, you know, we still haven't given up on working on the feature film. There's very few human interest stories like that I've come along. And I think it would make compelling television or a compelling film. And if that happens, then that takes this content and the value of this content and it'll expose it and open up people's eyes as to the kind of material that he shot.
And who he was.
And who he was as well. Because he was a brave man. I mean, he was, you know, in terms of where journalists go and what they do, he was amongst, you know, the best ever. And for a kid that was born in a slum in Nairobi with no education to become one of the best in the world at what he did, that's something that everyone can emulate. And that was one of the things that he taught me, is that it doesn't matter where you come from. If you have the passion, you can do anything you want.
Chip Duncan is a Milwaukee-based photojournalist and filmmaker. Salim Amin is a Nairobi-based journalist and documentary maker and the son of photojournalist Mohammed Amin.
An exhibit of Mohammed Amin's and Chip Duncan's work called Inspiring Change is on display at the Charles Alice Museum through mid-October. You can see some of the images from the exhibit at WUWM.com.
One more break and then the distinctive voice and the vintage guitar of singer-songwriter Caitlin Candy. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich.
Took a long way to come here. Got a long way to go.
You might think that the number of biology majors who have gone into songwriting as a profession would be pretty small, and that may be, yet we've managed to have two people who fit that description in our performance studio in just the past couple of weeks.
We talked with Mark Arelli, holder of a master's degree in biology, on this show not too long ago. Caitlin Canty's biology work came as an undergraduate, but today the Vermont native is a Nashville-based singer-songwriter. She's worked with the likes of Wisconsin's Jeffrey Foucault, Peter Bradley Adams, and others.
Canty played a pair of shows in Oconomowoc last week, but joined us in the studio first to share a few songs, including this one from her 2015 album Reckless Skyline, a song called Get Up.
Took a long way to come here. Got a long way. Get up, get up, get up. No time to rest or run for cover. Get up, get up, get up before the road pulls you under.
Caitlin Canty, thank you so much. Great song.
Thank you very much.
That was Get Up from Reckless Skyline.
Yeah.
And welcome to Milwaukee. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you.
So how did a biology major from Vermont end up living the life of a singer or songwriter in Nashville?
Well, I went to college and I liked science, so that's what I majored in. I also really loved music. I never thought it was a real practical career. Still don't. But I loved it. And I worked for 5 years after college and I sang some backup in New York City and I played in the clubs that would have me, and I wrote more songs that I thought I could stand on, you know? And so, I don't know, I never really meant to be a musician. I just couldn't stand not making music.
Was there an epiphany moment when you said, okay, you know, I'm either going to do it or I'm not going to do it?
Yeah, I was 5 years in when I started. My first job right out of college was working for the Artist Den, which is a live music production company. So I got to, you know, learn the ropes of this odd music business and what a writer is and what a green room is and hang around artists and see what they were. But that was a good education. And then I started to work. I used my degree at a green consulting firm. At the time, we were working for Fortune 500. So I was working in a suit, in a cubicle, in a tall building in New York City, and, you know, going to a club in New York at night at Rockwood Music Hall to sing. It was a weird double life to be living. But I did hit a moment where I actually was up for a promotion and I quit. I just really felt like if I didn't give it a try, I never would do it. And that anniversary was 5 days ago, and it was 9 years anniversary.
Wow.
So I raise a glass on that one.
Yeah, congratulations.
Thanks.
So in the chronology of Caitlin Canty, there was a period where you were still in New York and you were
decade,
playing.
Decade,
okay.
Fact.
Oh,
yeah, a decade. But you know, your part of the country has a lot of my favorite corners to play in. I'm actually this is probably my fourth year coming to do a doubleheader in Oconomowoc at the Three Brothers Farm. It's a beautiful. It's a flower farm and a chicken farm, and the grandson of the original owner. I play in this beautiful old dairy barn that his grandfather built, and it's like it feels like a cathedral, a wooden cathedral out in the middle of this beautiful country.
So when you play a dairy barn, mm-hmm. a converted dairy barn, do you feel some kinship or some connection with growing up in Vermont?
Well, I grew up in a town, but I actually think Wisconsin's a lot like Vermont. It's, you know, we have the same kind of exports. Cheese.
So very cow-intensive.
Exactly, cow-intensive. And the landscape does remind me of home. We've got a few more taller mountains and tinier little towns. You've got a little more sky out here.
Talk about how you found your voice as a songwriter, either your writing voice or your, you know, your literal singing voice.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question. I don't know exactly. I can't really pinpoint the second where I was like, aha. A lot of it had to do with, so the type of voice I have, you know, kind of a alto, dusty, crackly voice, and love the lower sounds. I got this guitar, this Recording King, this old, it's 1939. Like,
I was going to say, almost 80 years old.
It's just like a friend of mine at this point. I love this old guitar. Around that same time, too, I was writing songs that were pushing the envelope more for me than they had before. And I don't know, when I was a little kid, you know, you think anyone who's a singer, they must have just been wanting to do this their whole lives. I just loved singing. And I remember people would ask me when I was little, you want to be a singer when you grow up? And at that time, the only people I knew were, you know, Mariah Carey and Whitney Houston. And the way they cartwheel with their voices, the general vocal acrobatics, I mean, I was like, hell no. No way. I don't want to dance around on stage. But once I got an acoustic guitar, I think that helped me find my way. I think in college, discovering people like Gillian Welch and listening to Johnny Cash. I grew up on Tom Petty, but once I got obsessed with songs and like, and wondering, you know, when a song hits you and when it sticks to you or when it stings you, like, how does that work? You know, what made that happen? I wanna do that. Yeah, I wanna figure out how that works. And so that's this sort of many-pronged approach to finding my voice, I think. But
so when did that guitar enter your life?
Boy, I think maybe 2012 or 13. Yeah.
How long does it go between the time you acquire a piece like that? Because that guitar had been in, I'm sure, maybe it was a single-owner guitar. But
yeah, I don't know.
That guitar would have passed through the hands of at least a few people over those years. How long between the time that you get a guitar like that and it feels like a part of you?
Oh, well, I'd never had this experience before, but I walked into a music store. I didn't intend to buy an old guitar. They're kind of fussy. I use a lot of capos when I'm writing and when I'm playing live. So I was told, if you don't want to be tuning for half of your show, you might want to get a new guitar. But I lucked out with this one. And when I walked into the music store, I think a lot of friends of mine are like this, too. If you're not primarily a guitar player, or perhaps if you're a woman, guitar stores are not often your favorite hang, you know. I don't like playing while there's somebody, you know, on an electric guitar in one room over just wailing away.
You're not shredding.
It's not really the vibiest place to, you know, listen to your own, get your hands on a guitar. But this one, the world disappeared, and I started playing my own songs. I started playing songs that I, you know, loved. I started writing on it. I just fell in love with it. So it was mine from the minute I met it.
Wow. Love it. First strum. Well, and you know, I often ask people about their guitars, and partly because, you know, some of them just look more distinctive than others. But honestly, the match between that guitar and your voice is something that even a non-guitar player like me can tell.
That's so cool. Well, I'd played a lot of J45s, and one of my closest musical partners, Peter Bradley Adams, he had a gorgeous J45, and whenever I played it, I was like, this is a real guitar. But I think that suits more of at least his voice, or more of a man's voice, or that deeper sound. And this one's a little, I don't know, more nasally or punchy. I enjoyed singing with it, so thank you. I'm glad you think we work well together.
we should hear another song on
it. Oh yeah, for sure. How about, so I've got this new record called Motel Bouquet. Noam Pokelny produced it. You probably know him. He's a banjo player in Nashville. He is in the band Punch Brothers. We cut this whole record in Nashville, and it just came out. Is it last month? It's now a month and a few weeks ago. This song's called Motel.
In a motel with a bouquet in the ice pail, you can tell them I'm doing okay, doing real well. I got six strings in the morning. The rain danced on the roof last night. Moon rose without warning. Took his time crossing the sky. I could tell you about lonely roads and highway. I could warn you about the trouble and the time it takes. But California woke up this morning with a sweet refrain. Yellow sun beat on the window. The light cut straight through the blinds. It was love that broke my sorrow, like day breaks a night. Yellow sun beat on the window. The light cut straight through the blinds. It was love that broke my sorrow, like a day breaks a long night. In a motel with a bouquet in the ice pail. You can tell them I'm doing okay, doing real well.
Oh my gosh, what a great song.
Oh, thank you.
Goosebumps.
Oh, well, you know, I just was flying through Baltimore's airport,
BWI,
the
yes.
other day, and I started that song in California, but I finished it, this doesn't happen for me often, on a delay in that airport. I walked right by the escalator where I had, tried to crouch down out of sight, and just, I had the song in my head, and I didn't want to get it down, felt very urgent, and that, anyway, it was kind of cool to walk by the scene of the crime.
One of the things that I imagine that you get to do by living in Nashville, even if you are on the road mm-hmm. so often, is you get to be part of that network that exists. And, I mean, you've obviously been doing this for a while now, but I'm curious how you know when to lean on people like the people that produce your albums. We were talking before you started, the first song you play, the last album was produced by Jeffrey Foucault.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're
Wisconsin's
like,
own.
Exactly. And so, like, all these people that you rub elbows with, how do you know when to lean on them and when to kind of blaze your own trail and say, I'm going to do this like the way I envision it?
Well, so album production is it's an important cornerstone, I guess, of your music making. It's the only time you get to glue things down to the page in a way. But it honestly, for me, only happens every 2 or 3 years. So most of my time is spent writing songs and touring them around. So recording is a really intense time. This record I just made with Noam Pekelny producing came out of me trying to find my band in a new town. I did a couple different sessions. I did some trial runs. I was trying to find the right chemistry of players. And Noam and I had played a couple shows in town. He had joined me on a show when we were both out in Boise together. And he's just an insanely good musician. And I had been playing songs, you know, a couple of my old standbys, and what he would bring to that old standby. And I'd played that with so many wonderful musicians and had heard their ideas contributed to that song. But when I heard his ideas, I mean, he had just really a spark, you know. And so I had been recording. I had not been entirely happy with what I had ready to go, and Noam had played on that recording, and he said, well, I wanted to do one song. It's called Scattershot. It's actually what I'm going to play you. So good question. And so we went into the studio for one day to get one song. I had written a few more, and let's put a band together for one day. And it will be for an album, but, you know, might be a piece of an album rather than the full concept. Turns out that band, Noam played electric guitar. Paul Coer, also in Punch Brothers, played bass. Russ Paul, amazing pedal steel player. We had Jerry Rowe on drums, and it was in Josh Grange's studio. Stuart Duncan stopped by to play some fiddle. This one day, we got four songs. They just felt so right. The band was all Nashville neighbors, but just these folks who have their own, they're icons. They have their own personality with their instruments. They're really, they have a strong voice, but they're also such supportive players. So anyway, this was like so much fun. So we booked two more days, and that's my record.
Well, I think before we hear this newer guitar, I should say, Caitlin Candy, it's been a delight. So glad to have met you, and I hope you will grace our studios again sometime down the road.
Anytime. I come here at least twice a year.
Well, it's a date.
All right. I'll be back.
All right. Tell us, we're going to hear Scattershot, right?
Yeah, Scattershot. When I moved down to Nashville, you know, I'm from the Northeast. I was having this conversation with my friend Kristen Andreas, and we wrote this together. Just a conversation, a song came out of it. And I got stuck in a rainstorm that, to me, came out of nowhere. I was sharing that story with Kristen, and she had just moved to Nashville, too. And so I won't tell the real story this came from because it's not mine. It's a friend of hers who didn't get out of a evacuation soon enough. They got out with their lives, but not with their music gear. Anyway, this one's called Scattershot from Motel Bouquet.
Dark cloud like a gun, do you stay, do you run? Barrel pointed at the heart of the plains. Green bird on the wire, smoke before the fire. Dry leaves coil in a rattling chain.
Caitlin Canty's latest album is called Motel Bouquet. She was in town for a couple of concerts at Three Brothers Farm in Oconomowoc last week, and she'll play a show tomorrow night with Maya DeVitri of the Stray Birds just south of the border at Space in Evanston, Illinois. Our in-studio concert was recorded by Jason Reavy. And the music wraps up the show today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for joining us today. And I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.
It wants a